The Podfix Network.
Hello and welcome to episode 215
of the Filmmakers Podcast.
Yay! This is a podcast where we talk filmmaking from indie film to studio films and everything in between. How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to...
Do it so badly that you never work in this town again.
Welcome. Yeah, you did well. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for listening. Today we have on for you the guest, the wonderful filmmaker, Jennifer Sheridan. She has made the fantastic feature film, Rose, A Love Story. We're going to dive deep into that with her and have so much fun with her. We're going to dive in deep about how she made that, but also about her career so far and how she made, and how I met her, the fantastic short film called Rocket, which she made with just her and her dog. Evan, anyway, my co-host today, let me introduce him. You've actually heard his dulcet hair swinging in the breeze, I imagine. Or his beard rubbing against the microphone, because it is long and luxurious. But I would like to welcome the fantastic cinematographer, Andrew Roger. Hello, buddy.
Hello, mate. That's a lovely intro.
Thank you. Thank you. One day, you'll do it for me. Andrew Roger is cinematographer of some amazing feature films. Not mine on that note.
No, and some not so amazing feature films as well.
But he has also been behind the lens for films such as The Dare, World of Darkness, Arthur and Merlin, Knights of Camelot, which just all happened to be directed by me.
Amazing films, and also directed by Giles Olson. Yeah.
I've also lensed some other amazing feature films, including Confession, which is coming out very soon, Lucinda Rhodes Takkar's production, starring Colm Meaney and Stephen Moyer. So that, look out for that very soon. And you're also cinematographer for some amazing commercials and promos.
Yeah, I shot a thing for, I can probably talk about it now, I shot a thing for Conor Maynard yesterday.
Oh, did you do, oh, you did that with Tom Conlon?
Yeah, Tom Conlon called me up. Thanks for that, mate, by the way. I met him in LA.
But great, he gave you a gig. That's fantastic. And you, Conor Maynard.
Yeah, he's a lovely bloke. Very much appreciate it.
He's a very well-known sort of UK-based singer. He's probably travelled. I mean, generally,
yeah, he's a singist.
Yeah, he's a singist. Yeah. Nice. So it's good that you've been doing a bit of work.
Been a bit busy. Things are ramping up again. Yeah, a couple films in the works.
Ooh, yeah. I look forward to hearing about those. What did you take from Jennifer Sheridan's episode, which is coming up?
Yeah, lovely talking with Jennifer. She's brilliant. Learned about how she came up, really. How she was an editor. How that helped her, what that taught her about being a filmmaker. Oh, and why you should make a short, reasons for making a short, and reasons for making a feature.
What I took from this, and what you lovely people listening will hopefully learn from this, is she talks about way you should do your homework, but know it will change when you get on set. She also talks about not having too many expectations, which I really liked, and also how you deal with the millions of decisions that get thrown at you every day when you're on set. It's really enjoyable chatting to her. I really enjoyed it too, Andy. I think Rose, A Love Story is an absolute delightful film. It stars Matt Stokey, who also wrote it, and Sophie Rundell. If you haven't seen the movie yet, which has just come out, it won't surprise me, but please do seek it out. It's a wonderful, wonderful indie film, and you'd be surprised how much she actually made it for, which she doesn't talk about on the episode itself. But she's an absolute delight and a wonderful filmmaker, and I can't wait to see what she does next. So before we get there, before we get to Jennifer Sheridan and chatting away as we did, first of all, thank you so much for those who listened to last week's two episodes, the one with Christopher Smith, the fantastic director who's made Creep, Severance, Triangle and The Banishing, which is doing really well, by the way, now. So if that's any of you lot have watched it, I'm sure Chris will be overjoyed. So thank you for listening to that. And also the Mank special. Well, that went down an absolute storm with you lot. For us, talking to HODs, talking to people not necessarily we always talk to on this podcast, was brilliant. So if you haven't listened to that, it's talking to the makeup designer, the costume designer, production designer, and the cinematographer. It's an absolute delight how they work with David Fincher, and they're all nominated for BAFTAs or Oscars right now. You're hearing it from the people who are winning at the moment. So go listen. We have a competition, Andy. Well, we did have a competition. We have our competition winners to announce. For those of you who did enter, this was our competition where you could get 2 hours worth of crowdfunding facts, information and knowledge from the fantastic Peter Story at Greenlit. You could also win 30 minutes with me, but better than that, you get Cine Circle for a year for all their events. And everyone who entered, every single person who entered, gets the 10 myths of crowdfunding masterclass with Peter Story. This is an absolute winner. So for those of you who entered, drum roll please, Andy. The winners are Ned Haley Ray. You are the first winner out of the bag. Congratulations, you win all those amazing things. The second winner, Andy, is Mary Jane Lowe. Congratulations to you. And the final winner of these amazing, amazing prizes is James Webber. Congratulations to the three of you. Do get in touch with myself, with Peter Story, and you win all those prizes. And like I say, everyone else who entered does get the 10 Myths of Screenwriting course. That'll be announced when that is soon. You'll get an email in your box, and hopefully you can be there. There you go. Right, that was pretty cool. Our Patreon, for those of you who've now joined us with our new fantastic levels, thank you. It is going from strength to strength, and it's really cool. You can get some amazing things, plus discounts off our merch, plus you get podcasts before the rest of the world. You can get so many other benefits like Q&A live streams and early access. What more do you want? Go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/thefilmmakerspodcast.com. #SaveAndy.
#SaveAndy from himself.
So there are our winners, and that's our Patreon.
Yeah. So anyway, Joss, what have you been up to?
Oh, thank you for asking. I've literally just handed in, again, I've probably said this for the last couple of weeks, but I have, because we had to go back in and make final tweaks of The Stranger in Our Bed, my latest directorial work, feature film starring Emily Barrington, Samantha Bond, Ben Lloyd Hughes, Bar Edwards, Andy Osho, Nina Wadia, and the fantastic Joseph Marcel, who is the butler in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Wow, legend.
So we've just handed that in, Andy. That feels good.
Fucking brilliant, yeah. I just swore for no reason.
Yeah, it's a good, good fucking reason. And also, myself and Noel Sullivan have been diving in deep onto our comedy scripts. So we've been doing that. We have two of the projects that might be going very, very soon as well. So basically, just getting my head down and working really hard to make sure that they go ahead. I think that's kind of what we have to do right now, is just keep knocking on those doors. And I'm trying to close a film's finance right now as well. So wish me luck. And hopefully when I've done that, I can tell you all about how we did it.
All right, should we dive into today's podcast?
Let's do it. This is the fantastic Jennifer Sheridan. Enjoy, everyone. Hey, Jen, how are you?
Hello, I'm good. I'm in a hotel room in Manchester, which is very glamorous.
It's very glamorous. I was wondering what was behind you, because I thought, that's a really nice little flat you've got going on.
I tell you what, it's good practice for having to live in hotel rooms is living in a studio flat, which is what I've been living in for the last 6 months. So this feels like home.
So Andrew Roger is my cinematographer. It's not my cinematographer. Andrew Roger is a
cinematographer. I'm your cinematographer. I'm going to go with that.
Who I love working with and has cinematographed two of my feature films and one of my documentaries so far in his life. And that's great. So Jen, where we worked together, I say worked together, you had won the Virgin Media Shorts competition.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a few years after that you were put onto a video of like the past 5 years winners of the Virgin Media Shorts. And I came to direct you in that video that where we recorded it on a houseboat.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that? And we came to, was it your houseboat? It was a friend's houseboat. And we came and filmed on it. And then I put together the trailer bit of the last 5 years winners, and you were one of them, and that's how we met originally.
Oh well, I thought you looked familiar.
Yeah, we came to interview you on the wonderful houseboat, and you were fantastic, and we all talked about your dog and Rocket and the short film, and that was really amazing.
Oh yeah, oh good times. And then they played it on the IMAX, and that was really weird because my head was bigger than it's ever been.
because they had that. It was like one of the final Virgin Media shorts, right? And they didn't invite me, by the way, so I didn't get to see that. And I'd have loved to have seen it on the big screen. But yes, I imagine that your head, not because you've got a big head, but because on that big IMAX screen that they were playing, it must have been crazy, crazy yeah. close-up shit. Yeah.
Yeah, it was weird. I could have climbed into one of my nostrils. In like real time.
If anyone wants to see that Virgin Media Shorts version, it is on my website, I think. I think if you search.
Really?
Yeah, charlesolson.com. And then if you go, like, I think it's my short, I think it's in the commercial section or something like that. I think it's there. I might have taken it off now because I've done more since then. I know it's on my Vimeo. I've definitely got it on my Vimeo. And I can send you a copy and you can download it and keep it forever because it's really cool, actually. And actually, Andrew Roger. Our wonderful Andrew Roger. He shot some of the other stuff that's on there as well, but he just didn't do your day.
That's true.
So yeah. How funny it all connects.
It's nothing personal. It's just busy.
You know? It feels personal.
You should take personal vengeance against him.
I just capable of shooting that day. Like, the standard's definitely higher on your day. The photography.
Well, interestingly, there, so. That was the day, I don't know if you remember this, Jen, but the camera got stolen. Do you remember this might be happening? So as we came to set, the DP on that, the camera got stolen. And he came and we'd set all the lights up and stuff. And he went, Giles, I haven't got the camera. And I went, what do you mean? And he went, it got stolen before I'd come here. I hadn't checked because why would I? And I'd packed everything and the camera wasn't there. I don't know if you remember that, but it was a whole mad panic and we had to hire another camera and bring it to you. And I think the lenses were what we shot, were what Alien was shot on. And they turned up. Yeah, they turned up eventually. It was a right fucking ass with insurance and problems with that. But anyway.
So you're saying that you shot V with the lenses that Aliens were shot on?
We were going to, but they got stolen.
Oh, no.
And then they were found after we'd shot with you. Then we'd brought in some new camera equipment and lenses. Yeah, all in a box. So we were going to shoot with you on the lenses that shot Alien.
Oh, my God. I rewatched that the other day. That's so funny.
It's a good movie. It's
controversial
it's
opinion.
Transcended time. Alien. Yeah, all of us agree. It's a good movie.
It's very good.
Well done, Ridley and the team. And they did that. So, look, the Filmmakers Podcast is a podcast where we talk to filmmakers like yourself all about how they manage to make their movies or TV series or whatever it is that we're talking about. And we do it in a way that is, you know, general chat like we're doing, but we do it so our audience can understand and learn from the mistakes we made and how we can go about being better in the future and any advice we can give along the way. That's it in a nutshell about what we do. We like to have fun while we do it.
Oh, cool. Good.
So, and I knew you were lovely because as soon as your name came up, actually, when Marek from Signature sent across, he said, oh, would you like to interview Jennifer Sheridan? I was like, I know the name. And I looked at your picture and went, I know this person. And I had to rack my brain and go, where do I know her from? And then it worked out. I looked and went, oh, Virgin Media Shorts. Yeah, we interviewed you. So anyway, for us, look, we're obviously going to be talking about Rose, a love story, or if you just call it Rose, I don't know. We'll come to that as well.
Okay.
It's fantastic. Me and Andrew love this movie. We didn't watch it together, sadly. Nice. I think if it wasn't lockdown, we would have done.
True.
Holding
true.
Hands with popcorn.
just a little cuddle.
Just a little cute cuddle as we're watching it. And you need it with this film. It's a really well-made movie. It's incredible. It's your debut as a feature filmmaker. Obviously, you've made lots of TV and shorts as well. But still, it was very accomplished. It's felt really well made, right, Andrew? I mean, just the certain shots.
Obviously, like, beautifully photographed. And we'll get to it later. But one of the things was that the blocking was just so good and so efficient and so, like, it's just good. I'd loved it. I enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it.
Can't wait to dive into all that and talk about that. But for our lovely listeners out there, they love to hear. I don't know if they love to hear. I just do it every time. I presume they love to hear because we do it every time. But we like to jump back about how you started. And I know you went to the Brit School and I know that you worked your way in through editing. But what we don't know is how you did that, how you managed to work your way through the magical caves and those dark rooms where there's no light of the edit room. Do you want to just talk to us about your story, about why you wanted to become a filmmaker? Was there a film like Alien that inspired you to become a filmmaker in the first place?
It's one of those things, isn't it? Like, there's obviously everyone watches films when they're kids, like The Goonies and Beetlejuice and all these stuff, and you kind of think, oh, maybe it was that, but I don't think it is that, because everyone loves films when they're kids.
Hey you guys. Still amazing. If any kids out there haven't watched The Goonies, go watch it.
Yeah, it is amazing. And then when I went to the Brit school, my teacher was this really inspirational guy, and he was called Dean Peckett. And he was like, oh, I think you'd like this film. And he gave me a DVD of a film called The Eye. It's like an Asian horror.
Yeah.
And I watched it and I was like, oh my God, this is so incredible. Like, it's really creepy and weird. Like, at one point there's like this ghost woman with a really long tongue licking a kebab and holding a dead babe.
I
like,
remember
what
this. Yes. Proper dark weird horror stuff, proper Asian horror.
Yeah, and I was just like, wow, it was just not like anything I'd seen before. And I went back the next day, I was like, sir, oh, I love that film you gave me, it was like so good. And he was like, cool, do you want to watch this Battle Royale? And I was like, yeah. And then
How can I just ask though, why he thought, how old were you at this point, and why did he think that you might want to watch this really dark horror film with the tongue rolling all the way out?
That's a really good question.
I was
16, 17. It must have come out of a conversation we had. We had a bit of a fraught relationship when we first...
I know, he's like this, yeah. I hate this girl. I know what I'm going to
scare her away with this film.
Scare her away with this. It's absolutely crazy.
Because he set us all this task to analyse the first 5 minutes of a film, and I chose Gladiator.
Right.
And like analyze the first 5 minutes of the film. And he pulled me into his office after reading my essay and accused me of plagiarizing. And he said that I'd made up a film. I was like, it's Gladiator.
What? He's also wonderful, but also an asshole at the same time. And it's this weird juxtaposition I'm having with this guy, this relationship I'm now having.
Well, exactly. So
which must have felt the same.
I sort of thought he thinks I'm a bit of a joker and like not taking this seriously and stuff. And I was like, no, but I am. I totally analyzed Gladiator.
Did he not believe it's a real film?
What doesn't make sense to me is that it would be so much harder to make up the first 5 minutes of a film and write an essay about it.
Yeah.
Than just watch one and write an essay about it.
Totally. And plagiarize someone else's work on that would be, you know, even harder to do than actually do the work. That's crazy.
And so I had to bring in Gladiator and be like...
Yeah, I was going to say, did you bring it in and show
it? Yeah, I was like, here's the DVD for Gladiator. I can't believe you've accused me of this. I'm outraged.
I can't believe you've given me a shit mark. I worked really hard on this. Here's proof. Watch this movie, motherfucker. And then he went, I know. he probably went home, watched Gladiator and went, motherfucker, right, I'm going to teach her.
That was his way of like trying to make up for it.
Great. So you watched that and that inspired you, this crazy Asian horror, and then Battle Royale after that to go, yeah, all right, I want to do this as some sort of career. At that point, because you were at the Brit School, did you know you wanted to do, sort of move into the sort of production side of directing or even producing or even writing? Was it an early thing that you knew you kind of wanted to do that?
No, it was really that I was like, I thought films were super cool, obviously. I really wanted to tell stories, but I didn't know. We had a really good radio program at the Brits, so I was like, oh, I want to work in radio. that didn't last long. So when I went to uni, I did like a radio and television production course.
Just because you thought that was the way to, yeah, you like to see, there's something really magical about radio.
True.
I totally agree, there is. So I can see the appeal. I used to do a radio show at university. I used to really enjoy it. I think that's why I like doing the podcast now. But I used to really... and then I actually did radio properly. I did Capital Groups. I did the breakfast shows around the country for ages. Hi, that was Westlife. Hope you're having a great day. It's 6:22. Up early, like me. I did Partridge every time. Aha! Fanny!
Never stopped.
Never stopped. I still do it now. It's brilliant. So much fun. So I can see the appeal of radio. So, but then you were at uni doing that and you thought, oh, maybe this isn't for me, and thinking, I want to get my hands on the camera. Is that kind of what happened?
But yeah, because they didn't, maybe I didn't really read the course outline, but they, halfway through year one, they were like, right, now you have to choose. You have to choose between radio and TV. And I literally had two pieces of paper. One said radio and one said TV. And I was like, ooh. And then I just put TV in and was like, TV, TV. And then... Yeah.
And from there, you kind of like, did you make a short film at uni, or how did you start to make films? How did you start to do it? Because it's always the difficult bit, is going from, I'm at uni and I want to make TV and films, but I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, and I hope that the stuff that I made at uni never sees the light of day, because
it was so bad.
Oh, yep. No, it was terrible. But actually, what did come out of uni that was really good was my love of editing. So I started editing at uni, really loved it. And then I used to make like little title sequences and stuff for our multi-camera stuff. And my lecturer said, oh, I see you do motion graphics. And I was like, yeah, even though I'd just taught myself off YouTube. And he was like, I know someone that's looking for someone to do that part-time. And I was like, okay, brilliant. So I started working for this guy, thanks to my lecturer. And then he said, do you edit? And I said, yeah, I edit. And he was like, okay, just edit this little behind the scenes thing and edit this little corporate thing. And so a year out of uni, I was working full time for this guy, like editing just random stuff that he would give me. So I was really lucky.
That's really lucky, but also inspirational. It's like two teachers inspired you and one actually got you work. You know, paid work, I hope.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. What I just touching on there is the fact that you taught yourself to edit. Now, I believe that all filmmakers should know how to edit. You don't have to be an expert editor, but if you can learn it, I just think you become a better filmmaker. I mean, Andy, you could edit before I could, I think, in terms of, I mean, not in terms of competition wise, but in terms of, and I remember asking you for help, and it was the fact that a DP could edit, I felt was just wonderful. You know, I think it's so important.
Yeah, I'm sure, Jennifer, I'm sure you're the same way. If you understand that part of it, it's such a key part of filmmaking that when you shoot, you're more efficient.
Definitely, absolutely, yeah. And it's such a great place to, it's like a playground, isn't it? What I love about the edit is that if something doesn't work, you can just go, well, why don't we try this? And then you try something else and that doesn't work. And it doesn't matter if it does or doesn't, at least you're exploring stuff. And sometimes an idea can spark something that does work. And I love that part of it.
Yeah. I taught myself from YouTube videos as well. And I taught myself from banging my head against the wall. I find it so frustrating, but I kept at it because I had to. I was doing a corporate for someone and I needed the money at the time. And I just kept teaching myself, like, how do I do this? How do I do this? And eventually it was like, oh. And like when I started making shorts and properly doing it, I was like, oh, okay, the coverage is so important. You learn so much from editing. Just so vital that people really think about that as filmmakers and go, yeah, I'm just going to put myself on a course, or I'm going to watch YouTube videos, or I'm just going to shoot some snails in the garden, a snail race, and I'm going to edit it together. It's a long short. But it could win you a Virgin Media short, so there is that. So you went from there to going, okay, I'm working in this company, I'm getting paid work to do this. How did you then move into wanting to make your own stuff and wanting to direct?
So that guy, I ended up stopped working for him because he wasn't very good at paying.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we liked him a minute ago.
Well, he gave me my break.
He did give you a break, but he's off my Christmas card list.
So then I went freelance editing and I managed to get some TV stuff. And that was when I sort of broke into editing TV. But I really wanted to edit film and I didn't know how to do it. And I spoke to editors like Mark Day, who'd edited Harry Potter, and Mark Ecclesley, who'd done like This Is England, the TV show. And I only spoke to people called Mark.
They're the best.
It's so important.
Yeah, the best editors.
There they are, the best. Mark Sanger did Gravity. We spoke to him on the podcast. You know what I mean? It's really important. These marks make their mark.
Exactly. Mark Day said that he had built a relationship with a director who had then got his first feature and had taken him with him, so fought for him to move into films. Mark Ecclesley was like, I think he went the edit assistant route, where you work for editors that are already established in films and eventually they give you some scenes to cut and you get in that way, which is a longer game. And so I followed Mark Day's advice and just started editing short films for other directors, trying to meet and establish a relationship with someone that would then move up and hopefully take me with them. But all that ended up happening was that I was editing in my day job on TV stuff and editing in my weekends and evenings on short films. I had no life. I was developing RSI at the age of like 25, which is not good.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so your fingers go, yeah, it's like shin splints if you're a footballer. It's like your finger, yeah. Oh, even now thinking about it, just hurts and horrible.
Yeah.
Just,
and I realised that I couldn't really set my future on the hope that someone else is going to make it and take it. It just felt too like it might never happen. So I thought, I'm going to make a short film and just see what happens that way, which was Rocket, which won the Virgin Media Shorts.
That was your first ever short as a director. You're joking. If no one's seen this, by the way, I did look on your website and I couldn't see it on there, but I'll find it and I'll dig it out and I'll put it on the show notes so people can watch this. It's so wonderful. It's brilliant short that was with your dog was the lead in this as well. And it is a delight. It's a wonderful short. You can see why it won. So in sort of it, creative and inspiring.
Thank you. That's nice.
Let's talk about how you shot that then, because obviously if you're editing, you kind of know some people, but then you're directing, so you now need to know a wonderful DP such as Andrew Roger to go, oh, can you come and shoot this for me? How did you go about finding crew and putting that together and making it, or did you just do it all yourself?
Well, I had a 5D. And I knew some people. Yes, so I asked my friend Callum to come and help me. So he shot with me for a day, and then he couldn't make it the next time. So I shot a lot of it just on my own.
Amazing.
I mean, all I did for that short film was I bought a smoke machine from Maplin's for £30.
Nice. Really, we've got nice. One of those jars. We have.
To share a smoke machine.
There
you
go. Yeah. See, what more do you need? And then I built the rocket myself out of cardboard and. You know, it was just me and my dog, so it was pretty easy, and it didn't have any sounds. It just, so I found an amazing composer called Kato Hoban, who agreed to do a score for it for free, which was so nice. And then that was Rocket, just this 2-minute little weird dog film.
It is genius. And how I love that you did that yourself, and so you were teaching yourself camera techniques, even obviously you knew stuff bits, but still to teach yourself how to, you know, frame it, how to get the right light balance in there and all. Right.
Thank you, yeah. It was obviously like then when I won the Virgin Media Shorts with it and I won money to make another short, I was like, wow, I have made one short with a dog. So then I rushed off to make more shorts before spending the money on the short, because I didn't want to waste that opportunity and I knew I wasn't ready. So I went off and made a couple more shorts with like that were very short, dialogue less, pretty much little shorts, but had actors in and had proper cameramen and or camera people, I should say, before I spent that £30,000 on a proper short.
That's so clever. It's actually really, because most people have just gone, oh, it's, I've got £30,000 now. Let me just go shoot another one. But you went, no, I want to make, sure this is really good, this £30,000, and done in the right way. And as far as I remember, that short you made for £30,000 was also incredible as well. What were the two, before we get there though, what were the two or few that you did in between? Was that still you with the 5D going around shooting them?
No, I had my brother-in-law. He had a Canon 300, C300, I think he had. Yeah, so we shot them on that. They were just like little, one was called Catch, and it was about a fisherman who hooks a girl through the world and pulls her in out of her boat and into his boat through like a parallel universe. That was weird.
But that's what it's about though, experimenting and doing things to try, see what happens. If it doesn't work, what's all right. It's totally fine.
And then the other one was just like this kind of weird sci-fi about this futuristic game of ping pong. They were okay. They weren't amazing.
But you learned what you learned from making them, right?
Yeah. But here's the thing, right? With Acoustic Kitty, and I feel like a lot of filmmakers will relate to this. With Acoustic Kitty, which was the £30,000 BFI backed one, I was like, okay, this is it. Now, this is my break into the industry. Everyone's going to love me and want to work with me. And all it happened was I had a couple of meetings with agents who were like, oh, okay, what are you doing next? And I was like, oh, I don't know. Can you help me? And they were like, yeah, okay, nice to meet you. And nothing happened. And I think it was a bit of a wake-up call, because I was like, you know, you sort of, something like that happens and you think, oh, this is it. And then when it isn't, you kind of have to reset your expectations again, lower than where they were, and start again and try and figure out what the next step is. And for me, that was, I need to make another short that does, I sort of went on a bit of a tangent thinking maybe Acoustic Kitty wasn't festival friendly enough. So I made an emotional short and I thought that will work. And actually what I was doing was, it was a story I was passionate about, but I was trying to kind of please the industry and hope that that was the right thing to do. And it ultimately it isn't, because unless you're making stories that you want to make, you're not representing yourself well. And it doesn't even really matter if the industry goes, oh, that's good, or it's not good, because you've set your tent up as like, this is what I am. And I wasn't an emotional, you know, filmmaker. There are filmmakers out there who make, you know, heart-wrenching films really well, but I am not that. I'm a high concept person. I like big ideas and like worlds and sci-fi and horror and things that aren't totally just set in reality. So it was a real journey for me, and that's why I've made so many shorts, because I was trying to figure out who I was, and it just took me a while.
It's really cool to hear, right, Andrew, because it's so many filmmakers sort of do try and please, this is what the industry will want, this is what will get me the next gig. But actually, with shorts, it is sometimes just about making something that you want to make. And just sometimes they have to be your calling card. But, you know, you made Rocket, which is fantastic, but that doesn't mean you're going to make a dog movie.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's all about you as a creative voice, as a filmmaker, and having that as just, these are my shorts, everyone. Doesn't mean I want to go make any of these into a feature. You can, but doesn't mean you want to. And that's really interesting and really lovely to hear, actually, that being honest about what you do with shorts sometimes and why people do them. And what I found is once you, and you're probably the same now, once you're trying to make that first feature, and when you made that first feature, which you have, is no one cares about those shorts in the slightest. Yeah. It's irrelevant.
I know.
It's fascinating. All the work and heartache you put into them, and they just go, yeah, cool, you made some shorts, did you? like you made a promo for BP Garage. Yeah. You know, that's what it means to them. It's nothing.
Exactly. And actually, it's, those shorts are so much more about you learning. Like when friends say to me now, oh, I'm going to make another short, I'm like, okay, cool. Make sure that you're doing one of three things. Like either you're learning a new skill, like maybe you've never worked with a Steadicam, try and work with a Steadicam, or, you know, or you're establishing a new relationship with someone that you think could go forward, like a DOP relationship or an actor relationship that you want to establish, or a writer. Or you're doing something that pushes and elevates what you've done before with your shorts. And as long as you're in some way elevating yourself through that short, because I know people that have just made shorts and a lot of their shorts feel the same. And you're like, okay, well, why do you keep making shorts? Because you have to be pushing yourself every time and not resting on your laurels and going, okay, what can I do this time that's different and that is pushing my skills further? Because they're so fun, shorts, but they're also, you know, like you said, they're hard work. You hardly ever have any money and people are working for free, and it's, you know, they can be quite heavy going, but fun. But you just have to know why you're doing it, I think.
Yeah, I love that. Andy, your thoughts on that?
How did you jump from shorts to your first feature? What was it that made that happen?
And what's actually funny, having said that Acoustic Kitty wasn't what I'd hoped it would be, it is actually the way that I ended up getting my agent, because I'd sort of become quite like, I don't need an agent. I don't need people like the BFI, or, you know, I don't need all those people. Those people don't get me, you know.
Yeah.
I'm like a renegade filmmaker. That's going to work. So when I got a call from my agent, the reason that he'd found me was because he was on Catherine Ryan's IMDb page, and she was in my short Acoustic Kitty, and he saw that she'd been in.
For those who don't know, she's an amazing comedian / actress. She's brilliant. She's very funny. Fantastic.
She is great. And he saw that she'd made a short, and he clicked on the short, and he saw my IMDb page, and he just reached out to me and said, can I watch this? Because I don't think it was available online. And he said, and any other stuff you've got. And I was like, sure. Not really even knowing who he was, and sent him the shorts. And then he said, can you come in for a meeting? And I was like, sure. Not even really knowing.
Are you going to talk about Catherine Ryan throughout this whole thing? Why am I here?
Yeah. And I sort of went into the meeting with a very, like, I don't really need an agent attitude. And he was like, so what do you want to make? And I told him the feature that I wanted to make, which wasn't Rhodes, but it was like a passion project that I've been working on for ages. And I was like, yeah, so that's what I want to do. And he was like, okay, cool. Well, we'd love to sign you. And I was like, oh, can I think about it? And he was like,
yes, yes. Keep the power. Love it. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then I went off and Googled them properly and looked at who else is on their books and was like, oh, okay. Yeah. So I signed with him. At that point, I was starting to get work as a director in commercials. So I was starting to get paid for directing work as well as editing work. And it was a bit of 50-50. But then the commercial work sort of dried up and I was more editing again and feeling a bit sad. And then he was like, I've sent you a script I think you should read. And I was like, okay, cool. So I read the script for Rose. I was like, wow, I love this. This is great. And he was like, okay, cool. Well, I'll introduce you to Matt. You should meet. Let's see if you get on, which we did. And then the rest, as they say, is history. So
is long road down history.
Yeah.
It's never quick. I mean, maybe yours was. I don't know. Maybe you're going to say, no, it was a really quick turnaround, Giles. You know, I met Matt, money going in the bank the next day, and we were filming in 3 weeks. But I don't think you are. No. So from that moment of you going, okay, I really like this script, meeting Matt, who's the writer. Matt, I want to pronounce his name right.
Stokoe.
Okay, Matt Stokoe. You met him and yeah, you got on really well. You were like, right, I want to do this. How did it move on from there? Because great, you got an agent. It's a really wonderful place to be, to actually someone like Matt can send you a great script, because he's a wonderful actor as well. And he understands script. He understands that world. So it must have helped massively that he's written this wonderful script. And then from there, how are you going to go? How do we find the money? How does it work? So if you can talk us through that, it'd be wonderful.
Okay, so Matt and I sort of worked on the script, and Sophie Rundle came on board quite early because her and Matt were working on Jamestown together, and she saw that he was writing a script. She asked to read it. She had some thoughts. He really liked her thoughts and was like, would you mind coming in on this, like as a creative? And so the three of us would sort of talk through script notes and ideas, and they'd be like in Budapest dressed like ye olde people, and I'd be on this side on Skype. But it was really cool.
So cool.
And super collaborative. So we probably spent about 18 months doing that, you know, getting the script into a really good place. And once we felt like we'd done that, my wonderful agent, Rob Taylor, because the Artist Partnership, who are an agency, they represent loads of great actors like Uma Thurman and Emily Blunt and people like that. But they also have a development arm that kind of put people together and make projects happen. So through that, and through the fact that Idris Elba had just made a film that got into Sundance, Rob had these connections and just put the script with me attached and Matt attached and Sophie attached out. And we managed to raise just over half what we thought we needed to make the film. And then we tried to find some more money, which we got a bit from a company called Fields Park, who also have a post house in Wales. So they came on board and would do the post. But we still weren't quite at the target number that we were told by a line producer we needed to make the film. But I had met these two scrappy producers called April and Sarah at the Aesthetica Film Festival in York, like back in 2014, I think was when we met. And I was there with Acoustic Kitty. So Acoustic Kitty, for all I've said about it, has actually done me this.
Has brought you a lot of joy here. It's, yeah, this should be front and centre on your website.
It should, shouldn't it? Yeah, I feel bad now. But yeah, I met April and Sarah there, and they would produce loads of shorts. They were also actors and just really like great attitude, real can-do people. And we just made like a little short together the year before that was just for fun. But it was using a Trinity rig, which is comes back to what I was saying about I really wanted to use a Trinity rig. So I made a short where it's one shot with a Trinity rig.
Will you explain for our audience what a Trinity rig is, please?
So a Trinity rig is like a Steadicam, but it's on an arm. So it's strapped to a man or a woman.
Or a woman.
Or a woman.
Yep.
And it has this sort of arm bit to it. So it can go up and down and round corners, which is really cool because a Steadicam, you know, is you're either set quite high or quite low and you can't really go up and down with it. Whereas a Trinity, you can go up and down and round corners. So it's really cool. It's a really cool bit of kit. 1917 was predominantly shot with Trinities. So that's sort of an example of what it can do.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you.
So I brought April and Sarah on board, and I thought with them and their tenacity and ability to get great people together, we could probably do it for the amount of money that we had. And so we thought, let's not try and raise that last 100 grand. Let's just go and shoot it for what we've got and make it happen and make it work. And I'm so glad we did, because we could have been waiting for that extra 100 grand for years and years.
It might never come. Then your actors go off and do something else, and that becomes a problematic. You know what I mean? I love that attitude, and it's really lovely to hear so many filmmakers go, no, I have to make it for this budget because a line producer told me it was this, or this is what it should be made, or I heard a film like this was made. No, make it for what you've got. You can do it. You can. And, you know, you don't have to cut that many corners. You still had a budget. You know, you can still shoot it.
You can also at that stage adjust the script, you know. I'm not saying, obviously, if you've got like a massive shootout dinosaur explosion scene.
Which all my films do.
So, and that's like key.
Andrew's not so much. Yeah, and that's key. It's key for everything I do.
But if it's not key to the story, maybe you could lose the...
I've been told I should probably lose those sometimes. It's the first thing Andrew says. You took out the exploding dinosaur.
No. I'm convinced we can get the 18 million for the dinosaur.
And then 20 pence for us to shoot the rest of it.
Wouldn't be a Jaws movie if it wasn't. Sorry, <It's> Jennifer.
So.
Do you know what also really, really helps? And it comes back to what you said, Andrew, which is that when you have worked in the edit and you know the bare bones of what you can cover a scene with, if you've got 15 days to shoot a film like Rose, that knowledge is, I mean.
Did you say you shot that in 15 days?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's impressive. That's really impressive. Did you just not sleep? I mean, you're all in that little hut just going, you look tired. Perfect. I'm just going to shoot. 15 days.
Yeah. But I was really economic with coverage, and I tried to cover as many scenes as I could in like one or two shots. Like some scenes I'd covered literally in one shot because it's scary when you do it because you're like, I should probably like just pick this up in singles just in case I change my mind in the edit.
Well, you as the editor are thinking coverage. You as the director going, I need to shoot this now. I've got to get on with it.
God, but sometimes
playing with your own head.
Sometimes those restrictions, I think, can really push your creativity. I think restrictions are good in filmmaking. It's so weird being on this BBC show where, to me, the budgets are like crazy, and people are going, "Oh no, you can't do that." And I'm like, "But this is so much money," and you're telling me no. I think everything expands to meet the edges of the budget eventually. It's half of one, six of the other. That's not the saying.
But it should be.
Yeah, it damn well should be. So, okay, so now you're going, okay, we're going to shoot on the budget you've got. You've got your brilliant team around you, Sarah and April helping you do this. How did you then set about? Because, you know, the location's incredible. But like, I'm like, what? Where did they shoot this? This is beautiful. How did you plan to do this? Obviously, you'd spent 18 months on the script, getting it spot on, which is vital to do that, to really put your director's voice on it, but also to make sure this holds up, because you're playing with real money now, with real people, and you want to make your money back for investors and get it to a brilliant distributor like Signature, who are putting this out there. So how did you go about that, from that stage where you're going, look, we've managed to find some money, which is incredible, by the way, to do that, really well done. How did you piece it all together, and what was the lead up to the shoot?
Well, it was actually Sarah, my producer Sarah, who found the location. And what was great about the location was that it was a privately owned wood with a bunch of holiday lets cottages on it, and which meant that we could live there and shoot there. And then when I went to the location with Sarah and we looked at it, I was like, okay, like none of it was absolutely perfect, but that exterior cottage was good. And that interior of that house, we could use that kitchen and that bedroom. And then the bathroom in this cottage down the road is nicer than the other bathrooms. So we sort of, I sort of did it like that. I sort of, I said, this is our exterior cottage. And the interior that we shot in was actually a three-story house, and the exterior was just 1.5 stories. So I sort of had to create a jigsaw in my head and move the bedroom that we shot in, which was on the first floor, and pretend that it was on the ground floor. So we built a wall with a door opposite the kitchen so that when they go through that door, they're actually just walking into like a backstage area. But when you cut it, it looks like they're walking into the bedroom, which is on the first floor.
The magic of it all. I love this.
And yeah. Then we sort of created in our head the house, and then restricted ourselves to only shooting the bits that would make sense to that house existing when it didn't.
Absolutely. Whereabouts was this location? You don't have to say exactly if you don't want, but whereabouts in the world? Is it UK?
It's in Wales.
It's in Wales.
Yeah, not too far from the Brecon Beacons, a bit, I think, south of there.
Cool, south of the Brecon Beacons. Yeah. Yep.
Absolutely.
I know it well.
No phone signal, no internet, completely cut off.
It does sound amazing, which can be brilliant, but then sometimes when you do need that phone signal, that is really important as well, because it's kind of nice to be cut off. But yeah, if you do need that extra bit of petrol, or you do need someone to bring some food and you can't contact them, it can be frustrating.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, it snowed like really heavily. And we were snowed in completely to this place, which we weren't expecting. We were prepared for it because my producers are geniuses, but we didn't expect the level of snow. And we had to really embrace it with the film and reorder the shoot so that we did all of our exterior things in the middle week. Or like in the middle of the shoot, which we'd planned to do at the end, but we had to get them in before the snow disappeared for continuity. And it was quite crazy, but it really lends like a different look to the film that we weren't expecting, which is cool.
It's magical. Andy will talk about this in a second, I'm sure. But for me, it looked like Scandinavian. You know, it's so beautiful. Really did. Andy, please jump in and say how amazing it looked.
How did you meet Martina?
She was introduced to me by April and Sarah because she'd worked on a short that they'd produced.
Oh, she did Pandorica. Okay. And The Last Passenger. Right. Yes, I've heard of her. She's great. Okay.
She's fantastic. And she really relishes not using too much light. Like she kind of works really well with restrictions. She's also, I mean, such a workhorse. You can't get her to put the camera down. You're like, Martina, just put it down, take 5 minutes, rest your back.
I like the sound of this. I like the sound of
this.
Don't be giving me ideas, Jen. Yeah. But this is great. No, but you know, like you say, it seems like you have found a real team player there. What was the first conversation you had with her in terms of, you know, designing the look of this and talking about how you're going to shoot it? Because that's really important as well, working with your cinematographer. They are your right hand person on the shoot.
It was more about like the biggest challenges we faced were lighting forests at night. So it was talking about that, and I showed her It Comes at Night and said, look, they've used a lantern here, which is great because it throws light all around, which lights the face of the person holding it. And she was like, okay, great. So we did some tests. I ordered a bunch of lanterns off Amazon, and we did some camera tests to see which ones kind of were working. She's really smart, and she's very adaptable and like has just great ideas, and was a bit of a match made in heaven. really.
Yeah, I think her work on this is just incredible. Like, I Giles would tell you this. I don't love a lot of DP's work, but watching that, it's just so tasteful and so brave. And the stuff with the lantern, you know, and the stuff in the woods where you let the woods go dark, and that's how woods are at night. It makes perfect sense, you know. I loved it. It was fantastic. Talk to me about so the scenes where your actors had a lantern and they were lighting themselves in the scene. How did you block that through? How did you talk that through with them?
I'd sort of been to a place during the day where I knew I wanted to film the scene, and then I sort of walk them through where I wanted them to start and where I wanted them to end. You know, part of it is like, there's a bit where, you know, when they're sort of on their date and they're talking about what they do on holiday, and like they sort of end up at this frozen lake and it's so beautiful. And it is hard to see that it's a lake in the film. I don't even think you really do see that it's a lake. So they sort of stop and the camera just moves around them, and then it's behind them by the time they hear this noise and they turn. It was just getting the timing of stuff like that right with them, really. But I mean, Matt and Sophie are such pros. I mean, we wouldn't have been able to do it in 15 days without having actors of that caliber. I mean, they are just amazing. You know, they only need a couple of takes and they nail it every time. They're so great. So that helped a lot.
But you must have done rehearsals with them before. Did you talk? I mean, like, say, when you're working through the script with them for the 18 months beforehand, whenever Sophie was on those calls with you, it sounds like she was on them a lot with Matt. So therefore, you had all that time to work through the sort of the nuances. But did you also do rehearsals as well? You know, once you actually got the money and you could get it up on its feet before you got to set?
Like you say, because they'd both been so... I mean, Matt had written it and then Sophie had come and brought everything that Sophie brought to it. So they knew that script inside out. You know, they'd discussed it to every inch and every line, and they knew it inside out, which obviously helped a huge amount. So we did sort of read through stuff and we'd block stuff, but there wasn't a huge amount of rehearsals. They just didn't need it.
Well, let's just describe what Rose is for people who don't know, and then we can play the trailer. Shall I tell people what it's about in my Partridge voice?
No,
because that'll
don't.
Ruin it. Because it gripped by a violent, terrifying illness. No, because
right.
It ruins
you're
it.
Right.
It's funny.
I enjoyed that.
But this
that,
is a brilliant film that deserves the love
I
of
enjoyed
it.
That.
Doing it in a proper paid-for advertising voice. Gripped by a violent, terrifying illness, Rose lives in seclusion with her husband, but the arrival of a stranger shatters the fragile refuge they have built.
You're a good man. I'll love you forever.
Why are you being weird?
I want you to take me out.
And what was the food like?
Like really fancy fruit. Come on.
What?
Eat, please. You know, like lychee.
Yeah, okay, fair, fancy fruit. What else?
Grilled octopus.
What is the weather like?
So warm that you could sit outside and you could smell all the food cooking on the grill and smell the salt water coming from the sea.
There's just no way that I'm going to leave you on your own for 2 days.
The
I'm sorry.
Is, I want you to.
What if something happens to you?
Sam, it wouldn't be your fault.
Rose?
Help me, someone! Help me, help me!
I found someone. It's a girl.
Oh, my God.
We need to get rid of her.
Why do you live like this? The windows, the lights, the traps. Rose?
What did we have for dessert?
So, look, obviously people can hear from the trailer. It's so well made. It's really professional film. And I'm still blown away it's your debut. I love the fact that I met you you know, during that time of you talking about trying to make other movies, and the fact that you've delivered this incredible film is just an absolute delight. And the fact that it's getting all the love it is doing is amazing. It's totally deserved. It's a beautiful film.
It really does mean a lot to hear that. So thank you.
You know, it's really great. Honestly, you should be very proud of this movie. I can't wait for people to see it. I can't wait for it to come out on April the 5th. It's great. It's great. It's great. So let's talk about the making of it then itself, while we've still got time before Marek comes on and tries to kick us off. Like I say, this is a wonderful achievement to raise the money and go, we're going to go shoot this for what we've got. And you've got an amazing team with you and two incredible actors here. And they are both amazing in terms of what their work before and in this. So let's talk through your work as a director then, in terms of your prep and your planning. Do you storyboard everything? Do you shot list within an inch of its life? Or are you quite free? And obviously you only had 15 days here, so you must have been quite on it. Talk us through your process here and your planning stage, and what did you learn from it?
Well, I shotlist everything, and then I storyboard the more complicated sequences so that I've got them in my head. But then I tend to sort of, once we stepped on set, I would quite often, like, the shotlist is there as a guide of what I know I need and what I'd like to have. But quite often I'm like, oh, but this would be so much better if we did this, and or if we could make this all work in one, and like really working with what's in front of you on the day. But having that sort of, having done your homework, so you know, bare bones, I could cover the scene like that and it would be successful. And if we had time, I'd love to also do this shot here and this kind of thing with the camera to come into it and out of it and that kind of thing. But then it always ends up changing, because as soon as you step on set with your DP and you go, oh, that's where the light is. Oh, in my shot list, that wasn't there. So now we need to move people here. And, you know, being really adaptable, I think, is such a big part of filmmaking. And quite often just not having too many expectations of things in your head, like having a very loose idea. So that when you come on, you're not holding on too tightly to anything, and you can kind of just go, okay, yeah, that's not going to work. Like, how should we do this? And figuring it out in the day is really fun. So yeah, so that's sort of how I have continued to work, is I shotlist everything so that it's all in my head as a bare bones. And then as soon as I talk to a DOP, it starts to change and move. And then on the day, it changes and moves again, once you see the actors and what they want to do and how they want to move and how the environment works. So yeah, that's how I work.
Perfect. Absolutely. Same as me. And it really is important to do that homework first, like I say, and then throw it out. But yeah, absolutely. It's really right. How did you cope on set? Because it's something that we often don't talk about, is the difficulties of actually having your brain on fire for, in this case, solidly for 15 days. It's really difficult. I think I've probably said this, it's like comparing it to organizing someone's wedding, but the bride keeps running away and she's on a horse and you've only got bare feet and you're on that ice pond that we couldn't see in the movie and you're slipping and you've got to get them, right? That's, you know, a perfect example. And there's exploding dinosaurs going off behind you. So how did it feel? How did you cope mentally, physically, and what could you, you know, tell us what you've learned from that and taking forward to your next film?
What I was really worried about was, I was worried that I was going to get tired and that my brain would start to slow down, and I would, because I'd never done something that was 15 days before. I'd only ever done like 4 days of shooting in a row. And I was like, what's that going to be like? That ended up not being a problem, because actually the process itself was so exciting and invigorating that every day I woke up with energy ready for the day. But there was definitely a moment, I remember it very clearly. I was stood in the forest on a hill. We were losing light. One of the props, I think Matt's axe, had been left on the other side of the forest, and we had to go and get it. And there was this sort of deer carcass prop that had just been taken out of the box. And it was supposed to be a special prop that we'd spent quite a bit of money on, that had a pump so that it could look like it was still breathing and it was dying. And when we opened the box, there was no pump. So it's dead. This is an example of me trying to hold on to an expectation, because I was like, no, there's something we can do. Like, you could be off screen with a stick, just like poking its chest. So and that obviously didn't work. And then suddenly, like, someone came to me with a costume question, and there was another question coming at me, and it was like a really overwhelming moment, because I was sort of disappointed by that, and then this, and the prop, and everything. And I remember just for a moment, sort of my eyes sort of slightly glazing over, and in my head, panic stations. And I was just like, I don't know what to do. And in that, it was so crazy, because at that time, our script supervisor fell over and dislocated her knee.
Oh my God. Oh, the pain of that. I know.
And she was this really like stoic Irish girl. And she was like, don't worry, I'm just going to pop it back in. Give me a second.
Oh, Jesus, fuck's sake.
But it was like, suddenly that was the priority. Like, make sure she was okay. Get the medic up here. And once Orla was okay, it totally refocused my mind. And I was like, okay, here's what we're going to do. The deer's dead. I've given up. That's fine.
Not Orla, the deer, just so we're clear here. Yeah, great.
Let's string up the blood here. We'll shoot this scene here. We'll have him bury the thing over here. And it was like, it just refocused my mind. It was, thank you, Orla, for dislocating me. She bought me some time. And
you could get your head back in that. Because it does happen to us all the time. And I remember on The Dare, my first movie, my debut movie, and I had that moment where I had no idea what I was doing. Just one of those blank moments. And I turned to Andy, and I just went, Andy, I'm lost. And he went, no, you're not. This is the plan. Remember, we talked about it last night. You're going to do the wide from here, and then you come in the close-up, remember, and you're going to do the... And I went, oh, thank you. And it sometimes needs either someone to dislocate their knee or someone else to
remind you what we talked about last night over dinner. Yeah, it's the same thing.
It's very similar. Very similar. I don't know where I was going with that. But it does. It's sometimes having people around you, or having the mindset to just stop for a moment and go, it's okay. You're allowed to have these moments. You're allowed to do that. It's okay to say, I don't know. Just give me a minute. Let me think. Or say yes to something and then change your mind and go, actually, nah, I've changed my mind. I know you've just spent ages putting your blood on that, or I know you've spent ages art directing that, but I've changed my mind. It's okay to do it, as long as you do it in the right way, to say it's going to be better for the film. I'm not doing it to piss you off.
No, do you know what? You're so right, because since that, I've spoken to other directors and I've told them that story, and they've been like, oh my God, yeah, I had that exact same thing on this show that I was doing. I think because you're making a million decisions a second as a director, and everyone comes to you with the questions, and you feel that responsibility of, that you need to have answers, even when you don't know the answer immediately in that moment. Like, it could be as simple as someone coming and saying, do you want this green top or this red top for the next scene? And you just go, but you have to go red top. And then when you see it on screen, you're like, have you got that green top?
Yeah, you know, I said red. I didn't mean red. What I meant was green red.
Yeah, green. Exactly. Yes, correct. But also,
it's so true. But you're allowed to do that.
Yeah. Have you guys read a book called True Indie, Life and Death in...
Oh, True Indie. Dan Coscarelli. That's it. Yes. Yeah, yes. I have read that one. It's really good.
Really good. And what I love about his book is that he's really relatable, but he'll also at the end, he gives you this like 5-page, like quick film school on how to shoot an indie film and the rules that you should do. And I was breaking every rule that he was like, try not to shoot for more than 4 days. We were doing like 6-day weeks. He was like, try not to have dialogue pages that are more than like dialogue scenes that are more than 3 pages. And I was like, oh, you know, and all this stuff. And it really threw me. I mean, it was a great book, but it really threw me before the film, because I thought, I'm doing this all wrong, but it's too late.
Fuck it. Rules are there to be broken. Right?
Definitely.
Yeah. And you, like say, you've made a brilliant film and you've, like say, you learned from that. What would you tell yourself now looking back, and what could you tell people moving forward? Sort of, if you could have a word with yourself now of a young Jennifer going about to make this film to the older Jennifer, is there anything you would advise her on?
I would say trust your instincts and stop and don't worry about, like, try not to worry about other people's expectations. Just set your own expectations, and then if you can meet those, or at least feel like you've done the best in every scenario that you could with the tools that you have and the knowledge that you have at that moment, don't beat yourself up afterwards because you have the power of hindsight. You know, just be trusting of yourself and your instincts, because at the end of the day, in those moments that you, that we just spoke about, that's what you're relying on. And when they pay off, it's so incredible. When you get into the edit and you go, oh, I really risked that, only covering that scene with one shot, but it totally works, and it's actually my favorite part of the film. That's so rewarding. It's such a good feeling.
Yeah, no, it so is. And I was lucky on The Dead to have Andy there a few times when I'd said, I'm just doing one shot on this. I'm just having the coverage, just going to follow the boy all the way on this one long lens. And I remember at one point on that, and Andy, I'm sure remember this, and I just went, oh, Andy, I'm really worried about the edit now. My edit, I was like, let's put a different lens on. Let's shoot this. And Andy, can you remember what you said to me?
I don't know. Was it near lunchtime? Because it's...
I think it was something like, fuck off, mate. We decided this was great. You know, it's great.
Stick
trust
to the plan,
in yourself.
Right? If you got one.
Stick to the plan. If you've got one. Yeah, but you did. You did say that. And it's so important. And it's just trusting your gut. You're so right. And it's learning from that and going, yeah, I know what I want from this. And okay, if I'm wrong in the edit, fine. I'll be it. It's my sword. I'll live and die by it. But being that wishy-washy thing where you're kind of going, oh, I'm hedging my bets. And then in the edit, you think, well, I could put it in. But then you don't, you know what I mean? It's actually saving time on set, but also in the edit of you giving yourself too many choices can be a problem.
I guess you save energy of the crew as well, right? I mean, if you're, and your cast, you know, if you're not doing 18 takes or something or loads of coverage, you can get right done that, move on.
And actors love it, right? Let's talk about your actors real quick in terms of that, and that process for them must have been amazing, right? Saying, cool, we're in here. We're just going to probably get one take or two. Go for it. Because it is heightened performances as well. You know, it's right. It's out there. It's beautiful. It's controlled. But, you know, there's a lot going on.
So Matt and Sophie are in a relationship in real life as well as in the film. Yeah. In fact, they're going to have a baby soon, which is... very sweet.
Amazing. How cool is that?
Yeah. But yeah, so on one side, that was great because all those intimate scenes and those shorthands and those little intimate moments were just like so easy to handle because they know each other in that really special way. But then when it comes to the scenes where something awful happens to one or both of them, they feel it a lot more in a personal way. And I hadn't anticipated that. I hadn't anticipated that asking them to do numerous takes of something quite where something horrendous is happening to someone that you love in real life is going to take a real toll on you. And it took them coming to me and saying, look, I've got one more of this and that's it. And I was like, okay. And I just had to respect that, because if an actor comes to you and says, I've got one more of this and that's it, then that's it. I don't agree in those kind of directors who will just beat an actor up for the sake of a shot that they like, or, you know, I think you have to be really respectful of people and take them at their word, because Matt and Sophie want the film to be fantastic. Of course they do, because they're invested in it. They were working for free and all of this stuff. So if they come and say, we cannot do much more of this, I was like, okay, fine. And I just adjusted. I was like, okay, cool. Well, what do I need now for this to complete and make sure that I've got it? And just, yeah, just trusting them and being open and communicative with them and asking them, you know, like there was a scene that's very violent towards the end of the film, and I knew I had missed a shot. There was a shot that I needed. And I knew it was a big ask to say, I need you to go back into this really intense scene right in the middle of it, just so I can pick up a shot. So I did a cut of the scene in order to show them, you know, the scene and say, look, this is where it's missing. I'm so sorry I didn't get it on the day. It was a continuity thing because the blood was at this level at that point, and, you know, and I just missed it. Can we do it? And I think it was that level of respect that said, that sort of got them to go, yeah, okay, yeah, we can do that. Now that we understand why we can do it.
Absolutely. That explanation and talking and being honest and open. And because you showed them the scene, they probably went, well, this is great. I can see now if you drop that in, it will work probably better for this scene. Yeah, it's so important having that open communication and being the voice on set, you know, that can do that. And also later, you know, these films will stay with you forever. You know, you'll talk about this film in 20 years' time. So therefore, you love it and do everything and nurture it. And it's about having the respect of everyone else who's working on it with you and treating them in the right way. So it's lovely to hear. It's really nice. And you can see that everyone worked really hard on it. And it does pay off in spades.
Another benefit to being a director or a filmmaker who can edit is that at the end of the day, if I wasn't sure I had the coverage for something, if there was any doubt in my mind, I'd go straight to the edit where the DIT station was, cut it together really roughly and just go, okay, I've got it, or I haven't got it, because we didn't have money for pickups. Once those walls were painted, that was it. So that editing thing is just, yeah, really, really helpful. Unless you can afford an editor, which would be great.
Next time, for sure. And I imagine the next film is already up and sort of in the beginning stages of moving forward, right? I take it?
I'm doing this TV show, which is taking up the rest of this year, but I've got some...
Wow, the rest of this year?
Yeah.
Holy moly. Okay. No, you can't talk about it. Right. This is great news. I can't wait to hear. That's great. Okay, cool. So yes, that's taking up that time. So therefore you can be developing something in the background, I suppose.
Yeah, and I've got a few irons in development fires that I've been nurturing for many years. That hopefully will be ready once I'm free again.
Does it involve exploding dinosaurs?
That's what it's called. It's called exploding
dinosaurs. It's called exploding dinosaurs. You stole my idea. That's amazing.
Don't tell me you wouldn't go and see a film called exploding dinosaurs.
Do you know what? I think so many listeners are going, that's a really good title. All right, I'm putting it out there. If anyone wants to go and use that title, Exploding Dinosaurs, you can with my blessing, but you have to let me know you're doing this. That's
it. Has
rule.
To be a noir detective caper.
Yes, it can't be anything to do with period dinosaurs. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much. Honestly, this has been a real joy. It's real lovely to talk to you again after all this time, but also to see how much you've grown and to see, you know, you turn into this wonderful, wonderful filmmaker as well. And thank you for your time.
Oh, no, it was really, really fun. I really enjoyed it. And I hope that any filmmakers watching can learn from something, my mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, loads of good advice in there for sure. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, so much. You're on Twitter, aren't you? I think it says here you are. Can you let people know your handle and then people can follow you, find out more information about the film, but also then say thank you for doing this podcast?
Okay, yeah. My Twitter handle is really embarrassing, though. It's, okay, well, it's currently at Filmineer, which is terrible. But it's soon going to be at Exploding Dinosaurs.
I love that. It's already taken. It'll be too long.
It's a bit long, yeah. Bit long. And then my Instagram is Jen_Filmineer. I really embraced it.
You can also change
I'm
that.
Not gonna.
You embraced it. No, please don't now. Filmineer should be stuck and forever. You can follow me at Giles Alderson, which is my name. And you can follow Andrew Roger at...
I'm too good for it. No.
Too big time. You can follow him at 35mm DOP, which is not big time, which is not come and find me at all. You can follow the podcast at Filmmakers Pod. Do come and do that. If you've enjoyed this, tell your friends. That's how we grow. And remember, you can go out there and make your indie film just as Jennifer has done. You really, really can. And if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, it is your duty to send the elevator back down. Jennifer, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. You've been amazing. This has been such a brilliant guest.
Thank you. Well, I really, really enjoyed it.
Rosa Love Story is out on April 5th. which could be right now. So do go watch it. Do go support indie filmmakers. It's so important to do that. Right, we will see you next Tuesday. As always, thank you so much for joining us. This has been amazing. Take care, Andrew. Bye-bye. Take care, Jen.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
See you next Tuesday.